CIUT 89.5 Toronto.
And we're back. It's a Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM, and I am Phil Taylor. Joining us, I believe, on the line is Montreal lawyer Paul Skolnick. Are you there, Mr. Skolnick?
Yes. Hi, Phil.
Hey, it's great
to
talk to you.
From you.
It's great to talk to you, but it's a sad occasion to be doing so. We've lost, in my opinion, a really outstanding man, General Gretchen Kabaligi. He died young. He was, I believe, 65. You were his counsel, and boy, you went through a saga with him. He was acquitted, and largely due to the efforts of his counsel. And tell us, what was he like as a man, this general?
He was a very interesting guy. Unlike most of the other officers in the high command at the Rwandan army, most of them had gone to the war colleges in France or in Belgium. Kabaligi was the only one that went and studied at the German War College. And he was very well respected in the army, was very well respected by the troops for his bravery. And he was a guy that commanded troops not from behind, but from in front.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very well liked, and it was very surprising that he was accused of 10 counts of genocide and crimes against humanity and extermination and war crimes and all these other things like incitement to commit genocide and so on. I wonder if I could just go back and give you a little heads up about how I think, in my opinion, that all came to be. Nobody ever talked about him as being a genocidaire or anything like that. He was really a very well-respected guy. What happened was when the rebels, the RPF, won the war, the country was in a very bad state. There was a lot of mass destruction there. And what they did was when they became the government, they put out 1,700 international arrest warrants to arrest all kinds of people. And basically, these people were military commanders,
mm-hmm.
anybody over the
mm-hmm.
the rank of lieutenant was on that list. There was every prefect, every sous-prefect, every burgomaster, every chef de commune, anybody involved in the administration of the country.
Yeah, blanket.
On that list. It was a blanket. They had no proof against any of these guys, or against most of them anyway, let's put mm-hmm. it that way. And then what they did was, they went out and looked for the evidence, and if they couldn't find it, they manufactured it.
Yeah, which is a great shame, since it was all done in the name of the United Nations.
Well, exactly. Now, I'm not saying that everything was manufactured, but with respect to my client in any event, because I can only talk about mm-hmm. the case I was in, you know, and I don't know what the evidence was in some of the other cases. But in my case, for example, I can give you an example. They called a witness called L.A.I. That was his pseudonym.
Mm-hmm.
And this witness said that on January the 28th, or he testified on January 28th, 1994, which is before the presidential plane was shot down on April 6th, mm-hmm. 1994. So let's say 3 months before, my client went to a place called Bugarama, and he arrived there by helicopter with the
mm-hmm.
Prefect Bagambiki and with Minister Natagarura. The three of them came by helicopter, and in front of 20,000 Interahamwe, which were the militias.
Yes.
At this Bugarama probably couldn't hold 2,000 people in a stadium, you know what I mean? Let alone 20,000. But in any event, that's what he testified, that there were 20,000 people there, and that my client handed out 60 grenades and rifles and uniforms to these militia people. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly enough, as you're well aware, in these kind of cases, we received thousands upon thousands and thousands of pages of documents in the disclosure, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And one day, like before the trial began, I was going through a box and it was full of all kinds of stuff that really wasn't relevant. All right, it wasn't relevant to me, it wasn't useful for me, but I came across a document where the prosecution wrote to the government of Egypt, and the prosecution asked the government of Egypt if they could provide information about General Kabilegi as to his whereabouts
mm-hmm.
in the year 1994. And lo and behold, this letter stated that General Kabilegi was in Egypt. I believe, now I'm going from memory, okay, this is a long time ago, but
yeah.
I believe that the letter said that General Kabilegi was in Egypt at the Nasser Military Academy taking military courses from January 10th, 1994 until April 10th, 1994,
mm-hmm.
which meant that what this witness testified to, that my client was in Bugarama on the 28th of January, 1994, was a total lie.
And they brought that evidence. They brought that evidence anyway, though that was part of the disclosures. If they did due diligence, they would have known they were lying.
Yeah, but they brought the witness anyway. And another trial chamber had declared him to be not credible in a different trial. Okay? So mm-hmm. the prosecution brought this guy again. And when I cross-examined him, actually it was quite comical. I said to him, I cross-examined him for a long time, but like at the end, I saved my punch for the end. And I said to him, well, you know, witness, you say that Kabilegi was in Bugarama on January 28, 1994. He said, yes. I said, are you sure it's not another date?
Mm-hmm.
He said, no, it's January 28th. I said, how do you know it's January 28th? He said, because it was a national holiday, la Fête de la Démocratie, okay, which is a national holiday in mm-hmm. Rwanda. That was one reason he gave. Another reason he gave was that somebody very close to him died, and this guy was a Muslim and had to be buried within 24 hours,
mm-hmm.
and the guy was buried later on that day.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to him, is it possible that you could be mistaken as to the date? He said, no, it's impossible. All right? So now I take out this letter from the government of Egypt, and I say to the guy, now listen, witness, I have a letter here from the government of Egypt that was written to the prosecution, and the government of Egypt says that Kabilegi was in Egypt at the Nasser Military Academy from January 10th, 1994 to April 10th, 1994. What do you have to say about that? He says, show me the letters. I show him the letters. He looks at the letter. He says, this letter's a forgery. So, you know, there was no end to their lies. I mean, I'm not saying that every witness lied. But this particular guy
is a problem, isn't it, with witnesses, they decide to double down on a stupid piece of testimony.
Exactly.
They don't, it becomes a matter of face. So the Egyptian government had to be lying. You should have called the Egyptian government and have him denounce him.
There were some funny moments in the trial, too. You know, I mean, it was serious, you know, because if the client's convicted, he goes away for the rest of his life. So it
was ugly. A very ugly situation. I was in court the day the prosecutor walked out of the court carrying Bagasora's passport. And the defense said, where are you going? And the judge allowed them to take the passport away and look at it.
Yeah, I remember. And they didn't return it that day. I've forgotten that until you mentioned it, yeah.
And they didn't. And when, at the end of the day, defense counsel, might have been you, stood up and said, "What's happened to the Where's our the passport?
Yeah, I was upset that they took the passport because the passport could have been vital to my defense.
I mean, how can
but I think eventually?
Have you ever seen that in a case in Canada where they can walk out of the courtroom with it? That's not a copy. That was his passport.
Yeah, that was his passport. It wasn't a copy, but I think eventually they gave me a copy of the passport. It wasn't going anywhere with that passport anyway.
But there was a case, and that was like Kabaligi, but in the Kabaligi, I think one of the important moments in your case was that they actually thought he was in Rwanda when the plane was shot down. He wasn't in Rwanda.
No, because the government of Egypt said he was in Egypt. Till April 10th, and the plane was shot down on April 6th, and then nobody knew where he was, but he turns up in Nairobi at some point after April 10th, and he's in Nairobi for a couple of weeks. We brought some kind of witnesses, but that's all closed session, so I can't go into that. Mm-hmm. But we brought witnesses to show that he was in Nairobi. He didn't get it back to Rwanda until April 25th.
And by the way, you've already profiled an outstanding officer. He had fought the invading army under the Ugandan general, Paul Kagame. He's a Ugandan general. And he had done very well. He was respected. He was needed. And when that plane went down, he was unavailable for 3 weeks to do the kind of work that might have actually at least caused a truce so a political solution could have been possible.
Yeah, because he wasn't only a general in the army. He was the chief of operations of the army. He was the number two in the army underneath the chief of staff.
Mm-hmm.
So he was, you know, the second most important military commander in all of Rwanda at that time in the government's forces.
That is part of the tragedy that is not known, is that, I mean, again, and you, through his acquittal, we're talking about a man who was acquitted of all these charges, but was, in fact, a patriotic soldier needed by his country. And the prosecutor acted as though he was in Rwanda. Am I right? Did they try to hold out the idea that he was there on the 6th?
Well, they couldn't prove that he was there on the 6th, but, you know, they tried to bring all kind of evidence. Little slivers of evidence over here, a little that somebody may have seen him, but he was far away. It was like 500 meters away, which is a half a kilometer away, you know, stuff like that. But there was a prosecution witness by the name of Ruggiu, which, you know.
Yes, I remember Mr. Ruggiu.
And Ruggiu stated that he saw Kabaligi, I think, on April 25th. Mm-hmm. When the helicopter, Kabaligi came back to Rwanda by helicopter.
So actually, that was useful testimony to the defense.
That was useful. Yeah, that was useful.
Ruggiu is a very interesting man. We should talk about him someday. But I didn't know he had given
that
evidence.
He was the only white guy that was ever charged.
I would say bless his heart. By the way, we're speaking to Paul Skolnick. He is a lawyer in Montreal and did a brilliant job at defending General Kabaligi, who was acquitted. Now, Paul, there's a tragedy attached here. Not only has the general died now at 65, he brought him into custody in 1997.
Right.
He didn't get into a courtroom, I believe, to, what is it, 2004?
We started September 2002.
And the trial ended 2000.
Well, the judgment was February 8, 2008.
4 years.
Six. We started September 2002.
So he's in custody from 97. And then you win his acquittal. He is cleared. And what happened?
Okay, what happens was he's acquitted, but no country wants to take him because he applies actually to come to Canada.
I wish he had.
I'm sorry, that's not correct. It wasn't him that applied to come to Canada. It was Ntaganda applied to come to Canada. But Canada has a section in the Immigration Act that says if you were part of a genocidal government, then you are inadmissible to Canada. And it's so vaguely defined. I mean, theoretically, if you were a postman in Rwanda, you might have been part of a genocidal government. You understand? So yes. If you were a soldier or you were a militar or you were a minister or you worked in the apparatus of the government, you're automatically excluded from Canada. So Cavalier was excluded. He wanted to go to France. His family was in France, and he had one daughter in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody would take him. So, you know, when somebody's acquitted in a case like this, what it means is it says to the whole world that person is not guilty.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's not guilty. And yes. Cavalier was the only acquittal that was never appealed by the prosecution. Every person who was acquitted at the International Tribunal,
yes,
the prosecution always appealed. But this acquittal was ironclad. They had no grounds. There was nothing that they could go to appeal on, so they didn't go. But the tragedy in all this is that although he was acquitted in 2008, he remained in custody another 10 years, not in real custody, because they took him out of the prison, the United Nations prison in Arusha,
yeah,
and then they put him in a safe house with a couple of other guys who had been acquitted that nobody wanted to take either. So yes, they were all sitting there in a safe mm-hmm. house in Arusha.
Yes.
They weren't free to go wherever they wanted. They could go, for example, to a restaurant or something, but they had to arrange for security to take him, because you never knew if there were RPF operatives in Arusha was full of them, that they might get assassinated there. So they were free, but yet they had chains on them, if I could say figuratively speaking, so that they couldn't be really free.
I wonder if you would agree with me that this is all done in the name of advancing justice and to be an exemplary, because it's United Nations. And were all these things, presumption of innocence and acquittal, meaning you are at liberty to be with your family? I mean, isn't it, it's a disgrace, is it not, that this whole thing went forward and he's punished after being acquitted?
Well, it's not so much the United Nations' fault, it's the fault of the other countries.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the United Nations, They tried every which way they could to get rid of these guys, because they don't want to pay to keep them in safe houses anyway.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So the registrar, I believe, really tried to get these other countries to take all these people, but nobody wanted to take them.
Yeah. But you know, shouldn't that all go back to this little thing called the Security Council? They had allowed that court to be established, and it was supposed to have certain rules and values. And so it should have been put in the lap of the Security Council, and they should have said, we play by the rules. This guy's acquitted. We all acknowledge it. He goes wherever he wants. Give him his passport.
The Security Council could have passed the resolution and say, for example, the government of France is obligated to take back General Cavalier.
Mm-hmm.
They could have done that, but they didn't. Because, you see, in the charter of the tribunal, which set up the tribunal, there is an article in there that says the accused shall have the presumption of innocence, and the accused shall be able to make a defense and call witnesses and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's in theory, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in the practice, once you're accused of genocide, you're presumed by everybody in the world to be guilty.
Yes. Presumption of guilt.
I've gone to listen to lectures by professors giving a lecture, you know, who never were in a courtroom at these tribunals, but they're teaching international criminal law to students, and they say all these things in which, you know, you would think that General Sedaris are the most terrible people in the world. It's like you're talking about Goebbels and the Nuremberg people and all that.
Yes.
And
Say they got more due process than these guys.
Where the presumption of innocence really, in practice, means nothing.
Yes. And thank goodness, by the way, that you were there and other criminal lawyers who actually entertained few illusions about the language of, we are ending the culture of impunity and all this, and that we guarantee due process. At least it struck me that watching, and of course participating as an investigator, that those lawyers with criminal lawyer background They simply said, you're going to respect the rights of my client. I'm not going to let you walk all over me, and I'm not going to play your game of, you know, he's under a cloud. He's not under a cloud. He's innocent.
Well, you know, there was a very, you know, the International Tribunal was made up of lawyers from all over the world. And, the British barristers that were there from England, they were very good because they knew the nature of a criminal trial because they worked like under our system in Canada. Mm-hmm. But you have lawyers from France, from Belgium, from the French speaking countries, where it's completely different, where the there's no cross examination. The trial is run by the judges or the magistrates who ask all the questions, and the lawyer at the end just makes a summation and tells the magistrate, well, based on all the questions you asked, this is why you should acquit my client. You know, so there was a big cultural gap there. Yes. in the tribunal on that issue, as yes. opposed to the lawyers from the common law like us.
They never actually agreed on what school of law they were following. I actually heard Kama say it was a blend. You can't blend those systems.
It took some getting used to, you know, because prior to the ICTR, mm-hmm. there were no other criminal tribunals. And nobody ever, like when I was a law student at McGill University, I took a course in public international law, but nobody ever taught international criminal law because it didn't exist. It only began after there were the Nuremberg trials and there was a Far East Tribunal to try the Japanese high command. Mm-hmm. But after that, there was nothing happened for 20 or 30 years. It's yes. only like in the 1990s with the Rwanda and the Yugoslavia tribunals that this all starts up again. So it all started like from you.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And so nobody had any experience with this.
Yes.
And
it doesn't seem to be getting better from what I'm watching around at the ICC.
Well, I'm amazed because I'm out of the picture now. You see, when I came back to Canada after Cavalighi's case, I did one other case of a guy called Kanya Rukiga with David Jacobs. Mm-hmm. And then I had to leave that case for health reasons. But then about 6 months later, I did the first genocide case in all of Canada of a guy called Munyaneza. Mm-hmm. And Munyaneza, I worked on his case from 2008.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the appeal. So I was occupied in international criminal law from 2002 to about 2010.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yes.
And then I came back here. But what I've noticed is the new International Criminal Court at The Hague.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, That tribunal has been set up, but it's not set up by the United Nations. It's set up by the state parties who agreed to sign on to that tribunal. It's not the same as the United Nations tribunal. For example, the United States is not a member of the ICC. Yes. Israel's not a member. I don't think China's a member.
Yeah, and you wonder how they get
be a member.
Calling it international seems to be a misnomer or false advertising, I guess. Paul, it's a been great talking to you. We used up all our time. You got a lot to talk about here. We better come back to talk more about what went on in that trial, because it's very edifying. And I got to tell you, you did brilliant work. I loved that guy. I thought he was a wonderful individual. I'm sorry he passed on, to my mind, young. And I look forward to talking to you again, Paul.
Yes, yeah, a pleasure talking to you, Phil. If you want to talk to me again, call me, and be my pleasure.
We will do that. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report. I think we're coming just basically close to the end here. I want to say, this is a wonderful guy. His Twitter account, Yasha Levine, and he has taken up the, you can just go Twitter, Yasha Levine. He's got a wonderful book, Surveillance State, I think. It's Surveillance Valley. Man, now I'm messing up the title. Anyway, he has taken up this issue of our deputy prime minister and the history of her grandfather, and we congratulate him on that. It's very, very edifying. Please go and check out Yasha Levine. And hey, I got to thank CIUT for saving us here today. Our techs were unable to make it. So thanks very much. And this is Taylor Report, and we'll see you next week.